And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is off. The Australian Grand Prix has been cancelled, and with Bahrain and Vietnam coming up but sure to be postponed as well, who knows when the F1 season will finally get going. It might be June's Azerbaijan Grand Prix at the earliest before we see some racing. But even though we didn't see any on-track action here in Melbourne, there was plenty going on off it, with the saga over whether the race would go ahead or not. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to untangle exactly what happened here are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Scott, coming to you first, you're looking enormously lively. You didn't look like you were just using your microphone as a pillow and about to doze off, so you got away with that.
No, I'm fine. I was just recovering. I was recovering from a slight laughing fit before listeners might be surprised to know that we don't always record these in absolute seamless one swoop. And on this occasion, I think Mark and I were caught out with a little bit of humour at your brilliant intro, a play on the usual excellent way you open the podcast. Very appropriate. I think you and I had exactly the same idea, didn't we, of how you should start this podcast. I jokingly said to you, you should start it with this, and you turned around and just said, that's exactly how I'm going to do it.
It's the obvious way, because the race is off. And it works, because normally I'd say the race is on.
But this race, the race hyphen, is on.
Yes, don't forget the hyphen, therace.com.
Never forget the hyphen. We've said it enough now.
But don't forget the hyphen. We've got to remind people to head to our websites. That's always worth doing. And also joining me is Mark Hughes, who's had a little bit more sleep than Scott Mitchell. So we're counting on you to be a bit more coherent. Are you feeling intelligible and insightful today?
Yeah, as long as you can understand my accent, we should be fine.
I'm sorry, what?
What?
Oh, damn. Yeah.
It was just noise.
Alan Partridge.
Exactly. There's always a bit of a Partridge reference in there.
What's it all about, man?
That's even worse. Does that sound authentic, Mark?
No, it sounds like he's from Wales on the way to Swahili or something.
Anyway, we should get on with what we're actually here to talk about, which is the whole saga over the Australian Grand Prix. We'll start with you, Scott, because we all came out to Australia. We knew there were some question marks about whether it was all a good idea. Everything seemed to kind of ramp up once we got into the paddock on Thursday. Every single media session, every driver and team boss we spoke to, there was a barrage of questions about coronavirus and the situation there. Is it a good idea? And Lewis Hamilton being quite strong on the fact he didn't feel it was right that we were there. And there was just kind of this growing sense of unease that developed all through the day, obviously starting with the fact that we knew from Wednesday night that some Haas and McLaren personnel were being tested for potential coronavirus. So it all just really, I guess it's probably Wednesday afternoon, it just started to ramp up, didn't it?
Yeah, what a weird week. You mentioned that the Thursday with the media sessions and the barrage of questions. It was a barrage of questions and a bunch of barriers in front of the drivers, which I thought was was quite, it was just quite unusual. And more than one driver came out and as they were went to sit down, the teams, every team implemented this sort of, was between a meter and 2 meters, wasn't it? A gap between where the driver would sit or the team boss would sit at their table. Then there'd be a little bit of a gap.
And then the filthy media,
exactly. So finally they got their wish and there was a bit of a barrier between us. But more than one would come out, they'd take one look at the barrier, they'd just go, this is just weird, isn't it? And that was, it almost felt like guilty asking them about it, because you're kind of like, I know we're not here to talk about this. I know no one wants to talk about this. I know you're not a health expert. You don't want to talk about this, but it feels wrong if we don't talk about this. So how do you feel? And everyone basically is just, this is just a bit peculiar. I mean, I've not got as much of a frame of reference to, so it's not quite as long a list of races, but it is comfortably the weirdest atmosphere I've ever experienced in the paddock. And there's two people who must have experienced things like the Volcano Grand Prix and the year after the Bahrain was cancelled. This must still be up there for the weirdest ones.
Indy 2005 as well. This is the weirdest. It was almost like a televised drama. You know how the end of each bit leaves you hanging and wondering what's going to happen next? It was almost like that, a series of those, you know, beginning with, is Ferrari going to be able to get out of Italy in time for even to happen? Yeah, we've got past that, and you know, and then that's the beginning of the next episode. But then it's building up. Oh, there's been somebody tested for corona, and then, you know, as it went on and went.
And then it seemed like it was sort of that at ease, because we heard that a couple of the Haas team members, the first ones tested, were cleared. So we thought, oh, right, that's all right. Though we knew there was a McLaren one who tested as well. So you thought the tension going up and down. It's like a brilliantly crafted HBO miniseries.
It's basically going to be season three of Netflix Drive to Survive. It's just going to be all of season three will be the Australian Grand Prix. It will just be the week or so worth of build up, and there won't be any racing in it.
Only the cancellation will happen on the last lap of the race, because everything in that series seems to happen mysteriously on the last lap of the race, even when it didn't. But
yeah, there's the false ending as well. Don't forget the false ending.
Yeah.
Where we thought it was all decided and it was off, and then the organizer said, no, everything's as normal, come in. Which was bizarre, because everybody knew it was off. Some of the drivers had even gone home.
Well, you were going into the track today when the fans were outside and couldn't get in. That must have been awkward going through them. And
well, they hadn't been told at that point that the race was off. They'd turned up at the time that they'd been told that the gates were open, but were told they couldn't come in yet. They weren't being told what was going on. Bizarre situation, surreal, and then it played out as it was always going to play out. But there was like loads of funny little surreal moments. So the three hardline teams that had wanted to race but had been outvoted, they were going ahead as normal. They said, well, until we're told otherwise, we're just going to treat it as a routine Grand Prix. We're doing pit stop practice now, while the team next to them was dismantling all their equipment. And there was another thing where the teams were told, if you can't use the pit lane to put your packing crates in, because that would imply that the pit lane is not available for the support races, which the organisers had put on. Thereby, the organiser would be admitting, if they allowed F1 teams to use the pit lane, they'd be admitting that the race was off, and they couldn't be the ones seen to be admitting that. So it was just the most surreal experience of any Grand Prix I've been at.
It sort of turned into, I mean, the one I liken it to was the Chinese Grand Prix, the Volcano Grand Prix, as I call it, in 2010, when the Icelandic volcano.
How do you pronounce it?
Whenever I write about it, I have to look it up and I have to do a copy and paste. It begins with an E, and it's got a lot of consonants in it. So I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it, although I might in post-production go in and read it out and insert it to sound clever. But the reason I compare it to that one is, even though Bahrain 2012, when we went back there after the year off, was weird because of the situation, I just remember in the Chinese Grand Prix, just the race was totally irrelevant. Everyone was just running around saying, oh, how are you getting back? How are you getting back? And people coming up with these elaborate ways of whether they were going to use the Trans-Siberian Railway or whatever to get back. You went to the US, didn't you?
I went the other way around to everybody else. I went to New York and had a few days there. Yeah, it was great.
That was a good move. I went to speak to the man with a airline company, spoke to Tony Fernandez, who ran the Lotus team, and went to Kuala Lumpur and then flew back to Stansted. So that sort of worked. But it was just, the race was a total nothing.
Yeah,
and even on Thursday, you know, this is the first race of the season. Normally Thursday, it's all anticipation, excitement. But it's just, we're talking about constant coronavirus and just laughing about the flipping retractable belt barriers, beloved of airports, that were just surrounding drivers.
But I tell you what else struck me as a parallel with the China one, the volcano one, was the initial reaction to in the F1 paddock of, well, how could this be happening? No, I'll just, I've got my own arrangements to get back. The real world impacting upon the F1 world, just, it's obviously nonsense. There'll be a way around that, and you know, there were certain parallels this weekend with that.
Formula One kind of creates its own little world, isn't it? Because it travels around, and it is, you know, for us, it's the same thing. No matter what country, the paddock is basically the same. The shape's a bit different. The buildings are a bit different, or whatever. But it's basically the same thing. So it's like this sort of city that moves around. So that's why there is a literal bubble, really, as well as a metaphorical one. So there is this feeling of, well, we're F1, we crack on, we push on, we get the job done. And in many ways, that's a wonderful attitude, and it serves Formula One brilliantly. But there are times, like you say, when it collides with the real world or a really big problem, and Formula One is just not equipped to deal with it.
Yeah, and the other thing is that Formula One is renowned, whatever it touches, it speeds up. It speeds up development in technology, and it
speeds up the spread of coronavirus.
Exactly. And this is the first time that trait has been such a liability. It's normally a massive asset.
Yeah, it's just a very difficult situation to deal with, and everyone's just not equipped for it. But the thing that struck me is it was that just growing sense of unease, because like, you went in on a Thursday, which normally you run around talking to people, etc., and it just thought, yeah, this isn't very sensible, isn't it? And of course, it was on the Thursday. It was basically the Thursday morning in Australia. So probably it would have been Wednesday. It was actually announced probably in the US. The World Health Organization had declared this to be a pandemic. So it was escalating. We knew things were getting worse, etc. And we were thinking, is this a really good idea? Should we be here? We were all there basically because it's like, well, it's on and it's our job to be there. But are we actually being responsible by being here? And every single team and driver, pretty much, with a few exceptions, if they were asked about it, they said, I've just never heard so many people express total confidence in the FIA, F1, and Australian Grand Prix promoters.
Absolving myself on that day. Having to talk.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is why it was such a brilliant, brilliant breath of fresh air when Lewis Hamilton was so strongly critical of it, because not only was a thing I was sort of saying, oh yeah, this is comfortably the strongest criticism we've heard of this so far. It's the only criticism we've heard of it so far.
Shocking, I think was the word he used.
Shocking and very, very surprised that we're here. And he said, obviously there was the cash is king line, and also said that when the rest of the world seems to be doing something, F1 is doing its own thing. And what I found really frustrating within the whole, there was nothing we could have done, or we couldn't have predicted this line that was being trotted out, is if you take any other aspect of how Formula One works and apply that logic to it, it just falls down. In a Grand Prix, the strategists don't go, well, you know, we were just, why does it matter what the race might look like in 10 laps time? You know, we're in the lead at the moment, so who cares? If you've got a weather forecast that tells you it's going to rain in 15 laps, you don't just leave like wet tyres or intermediate tyres just completely untouched. Yeah. Like the F1 is always about foresight and planning and preparation. And what frustrates me is that because this didn't come out of the blue, and yes, it escalated, and yes, it became a pandemic, and the true severity of it only became apparent. It only does become apparent with each passing day of a situation like this. It was still a situation a week ago, and the way it was ended up being dealt with, and the lack of communication over it, even if it was being dealt with behind the scenes and whatever wranglings there were, it was being dealt with and it wasn't being communicated. And it was just a failure of leadership across the various organisations involved.
Well, this is the thing, because obviously the key event was when the McLaren team member was diagnosed, confirmed to be a case of coronavirus. Now, McLaren announced this on Thursday night at 10:21. They issued a statement saying they were pulling out of the race as a result. And we always knew that if there was a confirmed case, then, yeah, there was going to be a withdrawal. And we kind of assumed that everything would then move from there. And of course, you know, the key players knew about this before that statement. So you've already got the ball rolling. And when we saw that, we thought, right, it's all happening now. This will be pretty quick that we'll go from that to race cancelled. But astonishingly, it just didn't go like that. And it was always going to be a highly charged political landscape. But the very reason that Formula One has kind of got into a situation where it was hitting and hoping with this, they're thinking, we might actually get away with this. And yeah, they might, that it wasn't impossible. Yeah, they might have done. True. You know, as Christian Horner said to you, Mark, that had they picked up the coronavirus suspected symptoms before, then
it wouldn't happen.
Hasn't travelled then. I mean, there may have been another one, we don't know, but, you know, it's small margins, but it was a completely irresponsible gamble, really. And we assumed things would happen to sort this out, but it's kind of symptomatic of the wider landscape that it just didn't go this way. The teams convened, and then the real battle, you know, there was no racing this weekend, but there was a massive battle between teams going on.
There is. There's a difference in opinion between the teams, but it wasn't just on whether the race should go ahead or not. There was battles between legality. Red Bull very unhappy with the Mercedes DAS steering system. Probably not coincidentally, because its rearranged front end means it's effectively impossible to incorporate DAS on the Red Bull. Also, the Mercedes rear suspension was the subject of a technical directive that required them to make significant changes there. So this ongoing niggle between Ferrari FIA on one side and their agreement with last year's power unit and the seven non-aligned teams. So there was a split there. There was a split a different way. Red Bull and Mercedes, and then there was yet another split in terms of which teams felt that they needed to knock it on the head and after the McLaren withdrawal, and which teams thought it was still feasible to continue.
I thought the last few days have been a brilliant example of how just chaotically political and competitive Formula One is, in the way that teams' self-serving interests, they can change on it like that, just based on what you want. Because Red Bull and Mercedes found themselves
completely aligned on one,
then
matter,
again then against each other on,
that's just that's standard F1. Yeah. you can be having an ally in one camp and they're an enemy in the other, but that happened simultaneously.
And then when it came to the decision over whether we continue with the event or not, they found themselves briefly aligned and then
yes,
and then not aligned.
They're not aligned again.
So they managed to get both in the same yes, thing.
Yeah.
This is an illustration of the fact it's never just about is this a good idea or not. It's always part of a battle. Again, Formula One's great because it's competitive.
Yeah.
But then that competitiveness spills over into the real world and just looks a bit stupid, doesn't it?
It makes it stuck sometimes, doesn't it? You can't go forward because there's such a struggle going on behind the scenes.
We were talking about the length of time it took to go from when McLaren did its announcement to the race being called off. So that must have been, thinking about it now, what, 1.5, so what, 10 hours, 11 mm-hmm, hours? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would have been, because it was about 9 o'clock this morning. It was,
yeah, exactly.
So it was about 11 hours. And the amazing thing was that there was a state official on the radio about an hour before it was called off saying, yeah, there'll be no spectators allowed in there. But so you had effectively official communication from the government saying no spectators. Nobody told all the spectators who were queued up at the gates here. So they had no idea. I mean, that's where, no matter what the situation, that's a failure, isn't it? That they have failed in their duty to the spectators there.
Yeah, 100%. And this is the thing that annoys me, is during that 10, 11 hours that it took for McLaren to make their news public and the race being called off, it was overnight, fair enough. In a normal circumstance, you'd say, okay, well, that 10-hour period is completely legitimate. But most of the people involved were working through that period because it was requiring these meetings. I mean, how we didn't get to the point, I understand that a 2 a.m. Australian time announcement wouldn't have been particularly particularly good or useful, but it would have been absolutely vital to stop people going to the track on Friday morning, because bottom line is the reason we're not having this race, the reason it's been called off, is because we don't think it's safe in the context of a pandemic, and the fact that coronavirus has been proven to be it's in the paddock. There are other cases around Melbourne as well, so you don't want people here and you don't want people interacting with people here because of this virus. And you've just bust in a load of fans in the morning because you didn't, they didn't make a decision quick enough. There's just so many elements of it that was a failure, not up to standard. I got quite irate about it last night in particular.
It was a failure, wasn't it? Because, you know, even the fact all the spectators were queued there to get into the track today, we had to basically sort of push through them all. Now, there was no clear advice given about exactly what the potential for exposure had been. We didn't know which McLaren person it was who'd been diagnosed. We didn't know exactly where they'd been, etc. So you have this kind of, there's that general standing instruction. Oh, if you've got good reason to think you've been exposed to someone, then ideally self-isolate. Well, that information wasn't available to us. We didn't really know. And you kind of think, well, what actually is the bar here? Nobody bothered to communicate that. Eventually, we found out that it was all right. It was actually McLaren who effectively told everyone that, because they put out their own statement on Friday morning, basically saying, right, we can explain a little bit about this. We've quarantined, self-isolated 14 other team members on top of the one who was diagnosed, because that's the 14 people who associated most closely. So you think, oh, well, if all the McLaren team isn't in that situation, then we're all fine as well. But what if that wasn't the case? You know, this is the thing is, people sort of talk about it as if the circuit's hermetically sealed, as it were. And there was this talk that you could have a kind of the paddock lockdown Grand Prix, because it's only, well, F1 who's brought it in, so they can pass it between themselves. What does it matter? It's like, this is a city of 5 million people.
Yeah, and after the paddock's finished for the day, the paddock people go outside.
So yeah, we are in the city. It's just unavoidable. We're using the trams, the taxis, the restaurants, etc., etc. So there was a failure there, because, and I was sort of arguing with people on Twitter about this, because I complained about this, and the point I was trying to make is we're not really worried about us getting it, but what we don't want to be is agents for transmitting and spreading this virus. And information is king in this sort of situation, and nobody saw fit to just sort of say, actually, do you know, this is a situation, which I thought was a failure of responsibility. As it happens, it wasn't a big problem, but that's more by luck than judgment. And we could have ended up with being told at midday on Friday, oh, by the way, you should probably isolate now, having hauled everyone into the track, having let them have 12 hours of meandering around the place. And then what? Then if the cases of coronavirus jump significantly in Melbourne, it's tied to the Grand Prix, which is a very bad look, bad for Formula One. And you just sort of think, with the stakes here, come on, do better.
Yeah, we are on uncharted territory. And so it is the first run through for everyone. So there's that, but
the caution rule applies, doesn't
it? Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the whole point of trying to contain this is to slow it down as much as possible, so that the hospitals aren't overwhelmed. That's going to be absolutely key when you read what the experts are telling us.
You've had enough of experts.
And so
I'm taking that as a no, I hope, anyway, otherwise you're banned.
So I'm not getting into that parallel argument with you. And so here's Formula One potentially accelerating it, which is, you know, whether we got away with it or not, it even coming here seemed a bad idea.
Yeah, I think that probably in retrospect that seems to be the case. And even as we're all heading out here, it felt like it was a real gamble, should we say. But coming back to the whole question of who wanted to race, et cetera, how much of it do you think was a pure what's sensible decision? How much of it was down to the wider political shenanigans? But how much of it was just down to pure self-interest? For example, Ferrari was pretty much from the start dead against racing. Well, we know Ferrari claims to be behind the curve in terms of development. They probably thought, if we start the season a bit later, that's not bad. On the flip side of the coin, Racing Point have got a car really well in testing, a nice benign car, they understand it,
yeah,
expecting a strong start. Well, I think we'd quite like to start the season, actually. And you kind of think, well, again, there's this extra dimension of kind of self-interest and competition coming in there that just muddies the water even further, setting aside all the controversies over legality.
Certainly, in the case of Racing Point, I can imagine they were raring to get going. Haas, who abstained from the vote, I would imagine abstained because they didn't want to vote against Ferrari. But I would imagine Haas really fancied it because, A, McLaren wasn't there, and that's sort of right in the band of that midfield pack that they'd be expected to be competing in, and B, they always fly around Albert Park. There's something in the DNA of their car that lets them, you know, that's invariably their strongest race of the season. So yeah, there'd be some competitive consideration, definitely. But in the case of Ferrari not wanting to, I do believe that was genuinely driven by, you know, the very, very jumpy already about the whole, you know, contagious situation in Italy and whether they could come or not, and, you know, carefully monitoring the people inside the team. So it was already a very jittery presence. And I think that just sent them over the edge. The McLaren thing just probably sent them over the edge. And I don't think they had any stomach to be taking any further part. They just wanted everyone to be safe and to somehow get home. And so I don't think that's so much a consideration for them.
And of course, the whole thing was much more real for those from Italy because absolutely, they're sort of further along in terms of this thing. So it's less of a hypothetical what might happen. It's like, right, that's happening. We've kind of lived it. Scott, we had the press conference on Friday morning with Andrew Westacott, the head of the Australian Grand Prix Association, and Chase Carey of F1 was there. It was interesting when the whole question of what Lewis Hamilton had said, that cash is king line, where he suggested that was the reason why they were all there. And obviously Chase Carey tried to bat that away, saying, well, if cash was really king, we wouldn't have cancelled it now. What did you make of that?
No, Chase was chuffed. He was well happy to have the cash is king line thrown in. He was, yeah, you could tell he was absolutely delighted that had been
he's
mentioned.
Being sarcastic, isn't he?
Might be a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, he needs to phrase it a bit better.
One my neck in. You could tell by just the way, you know, when someone's body language just changes immediately, like the second they've grasped exactly what they've been asked.
And the moustache bristles.
Yeah, exactly. The curls went away. It just sort of straightened out at the edges. That's how annoyed he was.
Cartoon-esque.
Chase's argument was that if that was the case, if cash was king, the race would go ahead. There wouldn't be an issue. I mean, I don't think it's quite that black and white. I think that's quite a convenient answer to be able to put forward. But at the same time, when Lewis made that statement, Lewis did follow up immediately with, obviously, I don't really know. And also, the cash is king line, fundamentally, like, from an F1's point of view, it's bad. But for people that are here because they have to be here because of work, if they don't come here, they're not going to get paid for doing their jobs. Like, in that situation, cash is king as well. So there are different levels to it. But I didn't buy what Kerry was saying in the sense that they were simply trying to play the situation in front of them and make the decisions that they thought were right. I think they made the decisions that they thought they could justify. And I agree with what you two were saying at the beginning, which is they basically were just seeing if they could get away with it. It was a bit of a roll of the dice. They obviously saw it as a risk worth taking. That wasn't just F1 thinking that. The Australian Grand Prix Corporation obviously has a lot to lose if the race doesn't come off. So they wanted to. They were willing to give it a go as well. Melbourne wasn't immune to the coronavirus situation before F1 got here. It was dealing with its own stuff, including that the women's 2020 cricket World Cup final. Is that right, Ed? Have I said that?
Yeah, no, the women's T20 World Cup final, that was on Sunday at the MCG, which I went to, in fact.
You did, exactly. I mean, maybe don't publicise that too much, considering someone from that event has got coronavirus, but there's that. The Albert Park Hotel had a case as well. So it's not like this virus wasn't in the city already, but I think what Carey's argument that, you know, it wasn't about money, it was about trying to do what they thought was right and eventually coming to the right decision. Yes, they eventually came to the right decision, but they came to the right decision because of a bunch of other variables and a bunch of an action from a bunch of other people who were taking action that Formula One and the other bodies involved should have been taking. So, yeah, I think Kerry was making the argument that maybe you'd expect him to make and probably saying all the right things from the F1 CEO's point of view, but put it this way, I think with a little bit of a different kind of leadership in that over the last few days, I don't think Kerry would have found himself in that position having to make that argument, which I'm not entirely sure he believes himself anyway.
Yeah, he knows he has to say it. I think it's you're pushed into the position where you have no choice, and then you say, well, we've made that decision, we've done the right thing. Yeah, not entirely convinced by that. But anyway, it is a complicated situation. Now, there's obviously implications for the wider calendar. There's a few things to talk about here. They did say in that same press conference, Andrew Westacott, the head of the promoter, basically said, well, although they used the word cancelled, he said that language was chosen very specifically, so there was no confusion. If they'd said postponed, those spectators who turned up might think, oh, it's a postponement of a few hours or something. Chinese whispers, as it happens. Nobody was communicating anything to them, as far as I could tell, early on, so it didn't make much difference. But there is a scope for this to be only a postponement, and they didn't rule out the possibility of it running later this year, but that's not going to happen, is it? That's
geographically difficult, isn't it? It's just a sheer distance.
Geographically difficult, calendar difficult. Albert Park is a temporary facility.
Yeah.
Everything's against it.
Exactly. I mean, if we assume that there are going to be further cancellations, and I think there are, you can at least imagine that you've transferred the summer break to now, and you can get restarted with some rescheduling and maybe some back-to-backs and eating into what was, you know, the August break. It's feasible that we could sort of claw back most of the lost races, I would imagine, just given a casual look at the calendar. But this one stands out as probably impossible to get back on.
Yeah, it's especially that there's local opposition to it still as well. It obviously takes over Albert Park, so it just doesn't really work. Scott, wider implications calendar-wise. We mentioned that Baku is a possible start date, depends how things go. But short term, we've got Bahrain next week. Then the third round's due to be Vietnam a couple of weeks later. China, the weekend after that, is already postponed previously. So short term, what's going to happen with that string of races?
This was another question that Kerry sort of dodged. Just, you know, I understand that he can't stand in front of everybody and turn around and say, yeah, Bahrain's off, Vietnam's off, because he was in Vietnam this week, wasn't he, trying to save the race. But realistically, Bahrain isn't happening, and that's going to be something that needs to be communicated or imminently. It certainly needs to be dealt with imminently, because they need to have conversations with their partners there and make sure that I suspect there'll be fewer hoops to jump through than has been the case here, but that will need to be dealt with. And Vietnam, I think, I really, really hope that what we've had over the last few days here means that what happens with Vietnam is a much smoother process, because with the situation regarding the visa restrictions and the fact that F1's trying so hard to make itself exempt from those restrictions to make sure that the race can go ahead. We know that I think one of the issues is going to be that the promoter in Hanoi really wants the race to go ahead, and it's meant to be the first ever at Vietnam Grand Prix. So a little bit worried that, again, going back to what Lewis said, cash is king. If you spent a load of money on the first ever race and you've lost, presumably the Vietnam Grand Prix have lost a pretty big number of tickets from Asia as well, because of what's been going on. That China is where the virus started. So there are going to be external pressures there to keep that race on, and I just hope that with what's happened here, the Vietnam situation is just handled a little bit easier. But, you know, Mark, you've seen a fair few like new Grand Prix in those sort of regions and these sort of cash sensitive regions, I guess, over the years. I don't how would it be naive to think that it will be dealt with completely responsibly, or do we risk getting involved in another situation like we did here?
I think the seriousness of the situation will ensure that the Vietnam government probably ensures that it puts enough conditions on it, such as the visa restrictions, that it makes it unfeasible, and I think ultimately wouldn't allow it to happen, no matter how much the private investors have put in it. It's not a government funded race, this one, the Vietnam one. So Vietnam has been brilliant at how well it has contained the virus, given that it's got shares a border with China. It's been absolutely resolute in containing it. So No, I can't imagine they're going to suddenly become quite blasé about inviting F1 just a few weeks after the escapade we've just had here.
Well, that's what doesn't make sense about the attempt to get F1 personnel exemption from the travel restrictions, because this circus is the last thing that a country needs to coming into it, and especially when it's a country like Vietnam that did so well. It's 22 days without a new case, and all of the active cases had recovered, so that was fine. And then they had a handful emerge recently, so that has spooked people, I think, within that country, worried that containment effort has been compromised. So we'd like to think the responsibility will win out there. So Bahrain off, Vietnam off, and then you've immediately bought yourself a few weeks before the Dutch Grand Prix. But then with everything going on in Europe, travel restrictions, spectator restrictions, all different kinds of precautions, who knows how long it'll rumble on for. And if it gets to the point where a month off isn't enough and we need 2 months or a little bit more for the pandemic to calm down and things to go back to normal, and we start in Azerbaijan, so be it. Baku is not my favourite place in the world to go, but it's capable of throwing up a spectacular or random race, isn't it? So maybe who knows, Sergio Perez and Racing Point winning the opening race of the season in Baku.
Well, there's a little bit more Canada chat in a moment. We'll have a very brief break and we'll be back after this to pick that up. But Scott, just coming back to what you're saying about the Canada, we kind of glossed over those early European races, Dutch Grand Prix, Spanish Grand Prix, Monaco Grand Prix, all scheduled to take place in May. And the feeling is that they're probably not going to work as well, isn't it? That's why there's this kind of natural couple of month gap, isn't there, in the season?
Yeah, there is an opportunity here to just give F1 breathing space, and this is part of the problem with their attitude towards Australia, Bahrain and Vietnam, is you've got this condensed run of races that are vulnerable to the coronavirus pandemic, but the timetable simply doesn't allow for anything to go amiss. So now that Australia has been toppled, it's like a domino effect. One goes and then all three disappear. We've lost China already, so the first four flyaways are done. We can avoid that with what's going on later on in the year, because sporting events around Europe and just travel between countries in Europe is difficult, and there are limits on the number of groups that can or the size of groups, sorry, that can gather. So you're going to have problems with audiences. And how's that going to work? Zandvoort's got his own problems, because obviously you've had the renovation work there. There's still a lot of work to be done to get that track 100% finished. That's the case if it's the fifth round of the season, which it was supposed to be at the very beginning. If it's going to start the year, it absolutely has to be 100% ready. And I'm not entirely sure it would be. But also, big part of what makes that race feasible is you're going to sell it out, because it's Max Verstappen fever. If you've got spectator restrictions still in place, and who knows, then how's that going to be viable? And same for Barcelona, which is obviously Spain's kept its place on the calendar through a late deal, but there's not a lot of money attached to that. It's going to be limited potentially to the same spectator restrictions, and if you can't sell the tickets, how do you make the money off of that event? So, and one thing that I was surprised by this week was to see how quickly the Automobile Club de Monaco put out a statement to say, look, the race is going on, but we're aware of this and monitoring it. I mean, if that's not an indicator of how wide-reaching this issue is, that's the end of May. That is the last of those races. And even they're going, hang on, guys, this isn't necessarily 100%.
Also, from F1's perspective, the Monaco one's not a big financial... It's a free race. It's unique in that it isn't charged a fee. So, you know, if Formula One was looking at giving itself a break from the virus, that one wouldn't be a financial hit. So I think that's why we seem to be gravitating towards Baku. But even so, even thinking that that's surely time enough, you don't necessarily know, because it's just how the virus mutates and it spreads. So we are in the hands of a virus that we don't know much about.
The pandemics don't really tend to take into consideration calendars and stuff like that, do they?
They're notoriously disregarding of such concerns.
Exactly. But if you look, for example, we're talking about other events that are affected by stuff like this. If you look at, just take football, for example, if the European Championships are moving from 2020 to 2021 to give enough time, now that's a summer championship. So if something like that can't take place, and I know that there's going to be preparation work for that would be affected by it, and that's part of why you can't do it. Plus, moving it back allows the European League fixtures that have been postponed for now to be played during the summer. The bottom line is there, you've got ramifications running well into the summer and beyond. So I look at Baku from the point of view as I feel like that is when the F1 season has to start for it to be realistic to get a decent number of races that we've postponed back in at the end of the year. Otherwise, what are we looking at? Like season-wise, this was meant to be a record 22 race season, but I honestly don't know what is a realistic number.
I think what I understand, there have to be at least 8 for it to be a valid championship. I think we'd be absolutely disastrous if we couldn't get to 8, but who knows?
Well, you never know. That's the thing, and it's there's some of these races are quite, Bahrain's quite easy to put back in because that's usable anytime. China's not the most convenient place, but that circuit's usable. Obviously, as we said, Albert Park doesn't really obviously the Monaco Grand Prix isn't an easy thing to put on. But I think the whole question of whether this is a proportionate response is supported by the fact that all these other sporting categories are doing it. NBA is suspended, Major League Soccer, we've got cricket games being held behind closed doors, Euro 2020 may well be postponed, we've got all sorts of league games in football in Europe cancelled, rugby, every sport is taking this action. It's very, very easy for people to say, oh, it's just a bit of an overreaction, but it's the reality. It's not, and anybody who says they know exactly how things are going to go in it is basing it on just pure guesswork. There's no way to say exactly what's going to happen, but there is space for a rapid fire series of races. The real question then is what's sensible and reasonable to expect. Do you go to a point where you think, right, okay, we're going to put 15 races in 15 weekends or something and just absolutely flay people? You've got to be a little bit responsible. In fact, MotoGP has constantly changed its calendar over the past week or so, and there have been points where there's been this idea that just be rapid fire series of races, and you've got to kind of think, well, it's got to be as well as possible to get all the stuff there. The people have got to be able to do it, etc. So there's a lot of factors at play. But yeah, this period of a pause seems to make a lot of sense. Well, that's kind of covered that issue. There were a few other things going on in the paddock. Obviously, Mark, you mentioned the Red Bull Mercedes legality thing. There's also this Ferrari FIA engine settlement, which is a spectacular failure of transparency going on there. There was a little bit of talk about it, a little bit of movement this weekend. So in amongst all this, there was some more of this.
Yeah, there was some communiques firing back and forwards on the Ferrari fuel flow issue between the FIA and Chase Carey jointly answered responded to the seven teams' initial queries. The seven teams weren't satisfied with those answers and had planned to do a follow-up, but events, coronavirus events sort of overtook that. But that is still ongoing, that niggle, and that the teams wanting to understand more fully what exactly this agreement is and what had been found, and that will still, that's still got more to play out. In terms of the DAS steering system, yeah, I think we can assume that when we do eventually get a race weekend underway and the cars run, if the Mercedes is seen to be running the DAS system, I think we can very safely assume that Red Bull will put in a protest and we'll go through that process. Whether it would prevail win that protest, I don't know. I suspect it's it will be passed as perfectly legal, but who knows? When things can be overturned. It's rear suspension, which was queried last year by Ferrari. Actually, the same type of suspension on the same grounds that its brake ducts appear to go beyond the prescribed area that is permitted. And last year, it was found to be legal because Mercedes could demonstrate
that the air channels didn't feed the bricks of the triangular section that went beyond the prescribed area. It wasn't for brick cooling, it was for rim cooling, so they could control the tire temperatures. But this hasn't satisfied them, specifically wording of Red Bull's protest of it the second querying of it the second time around. And this time the FIA issued a technical directive saying that, no, you can't have any channels there at all. So Mercedes had to do a hurried modification to it, although they could have saved themselves the bother, as it turned out.
Yeah, it's... good that there's a few of these topics to keep talking about on in the background, but yeah, at least gives the team something to do.
Yeah, brake ducts and a steering column is not a lot to be going on with until June, though. So, yeah, I'm struggling to think.
The race have launched a number of podcasts recently, Formula E podcast, most of your podcasts. We can do the race brake ducts podcast and do some episodes of that. The race DAS podcast,
great brake ducts of history.
Yeah, yeah. We could get Gary Anderson and talk about that. He'll
have designed some of the best ones, but he takes exception to the ones that are more than brake ducts, that are aerodynamic devices. I know Gary gets upset by that. I always think, you know, if he had a chainsaw and he brought a chainsaw to the paddock, that's where he would attack. First of all, he'd attack brake ducts with the aerodynamic appendages on them.
I just had when you were talking about the DAS there and the disagreement with what Red Bull's position is, the DAS disagreement. is there a chance that this delay at the start of the year costs Mercedes its technical edge? Because if, let's say, the DAS does get protested but it's proven legal, therefore it's okay to run, whatever time it would have taken to... Because the teams were saying it's a job of months rather than weeks to get it done. But let's say the season doesn't start until Baku. Yeah. Ferrari was developing it from the first week of testing when they saw it. I mean, what do we think? Is that enough time to replicate it? And if it does work, does that mean that actually... Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that's really unfair on Mercedes or anything like that, but they did a great job to roll that innovation out and catch everybody on their toes. And because of the way the season's gone, maybe they won't actually have any races where they have it and nobody else does.
Well, yeah, if you're not Red Bull, it's going to be certainly doable to get.
Yeah, everyone apart from Red Bull, I would say, is got to be looking very seriously at doing it, because it's probably worth lap time. The Mercedes wouldn't be on the car if it wasn't. And it's eminently doable. It's just an engineering thing. It's not new. It doesn't require some new trick software or anything like that. It's just mechanical engineering.
It's interesting, actually, because what Scott mentions there is how whether it's a foreshortening or the compressing of the season or whatever, we don't know whether it'll be 8 races, 15 races. But we could still easily have a 17, 18, 19 race season if they condense it. Maybe that's a bit optimistic, but, you know, we will see a reasonable amount of racing, we hope, provided coronavirus gets under control. But there's all these things it will impact. So you've got the development wars between the teams. So teams that were banking on starting strong and maybe holding that advantage. Racing Point appear to be one of those, probably thinking it's a bit of a blow because other teams are going to have a few months to develop. And then also for the drivers. So we've got loads of people out of contract. So if you're someone like Valtteri Bottas, for example, wanting a new Mercedes contract, you're probably thinking this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because kind of the neutral position for Bottas is, yeah, he's the right guy to do it. And that one of the pressures on him would be George Russell showing really well in a Williams that's at least able to race. Well, George Russell can't do anything to change, to build experience while he's sat not doing anything. So it's really interesting. There's all these drivers. And what does it mean for... Does it help Sebastian Vettel? Does it hinder him? I don't know, because obviously there will still be this countdown to getting contracts done, etc. If the season starts in June, you're still going to be wanting to get deals done quite early.
It's frozen their stature in time, whereas normally a season's dynamics changes their stature up and down. Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Yeah, and I don't really have a conclusive answer on it. Is it good for Daniel Ricciardo? I don't really know. He's basically a free agent next year. He'd be a great signing for various teams. Does this? You just don't really know, because it's just put everything in stasis. And I imagine if you're sitting on a nice hand like, say, Bottas, you're probably thinking, I like this. This is good for me.
Stick.
Yeah, but for others, it's really complicated. I think it will be interesting. We'll only really know this in 10 months' time when we look back on the season. We'll think, actually, that cancellation of the coronavirus, I can almost guarantee, will mean that the grid next year, who's in what seats, will be a little different to how it would be. I don't know how different.
Mm-hmm.
It might just be one seat, it might be seat, but it's all these drivers, it has an impact on. Nicholas Latifi was meant to be making his Grand Prix debut. He's now going to have to wait a few months for it. And just all these people who are impacted, it's interesting to imagine how that could change things.
Mm. And it is difficult to work out exactly, because it's one of those events that it just changes the path that we've gone down, and we'll never know exactly how it could have turned out, but it has set us down a potentially very different path with different opportunities, challenges, benefits and drawbacks to the teams and the manufacturers and the drivers. And some of those will be quite obvious to see, won't it? If four or five teams turn up to the first race of the season in June with the DAS, and you go, okay, well, that's clearly a benefit there, but the other stuff will be a bit more subtle behind the scenes and we won't see it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of sliding doors moment overall as well. You know, maybe Sebastian Vettel was destined to win this weekend. He's good around this circuit. Maybe the Ferrari wasn't quite strong enough, but you know, you never know. That could have changed everything for him. Just,
well, in this universe, yes, but there's lots of parallel ones.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. There's every eventuality. Yeah. There's one in which Pastor Maldonado.
We're only talking about this one, aren't we? In this podcast.
Okay, yes. Stay in this one. We have got a series of podcasts launching for parallel universes coming.
Oh, excellent.
Coming soon as well, including the one where Pastor Maldonado drives for Ferrari. I think.
Okay. I'm coming to them all.
Yeah, well, that's what we paid to do. We're being purely speculative there, but the impact on the season and on whole careers is going to be very, very far-reached. I guess all we can do is just hope that the global situation gets under control. That's the number one priority, and that, you know, everybody wants normality to be resumed as soon as possible, and probably the best-case scenario for Formula One, that's in a couple of months, and that would be if things go well for the world as well. So let's see how it all goes. Do check out therace.com. Just because there's no Formula One doesn't mean we won't be producing huge amounts of content about Grand Prix racing when we've worked out what to talk about. And obviously the podcast will continue through this period. Our YouTube channel is going to continue to produce stuff, so there's plenty to delve into there. So thanks, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, and I can promise you'll be hearing plenty more from The Race even during this hiatus.